people who were celebrated in my field for research success, they were all men, all white, middle-aged men. And I remember thinking, this is not right, this is not fair. So it became a moral crusade to begin with.
Det började som en rättvisefråga för Paul Walton, professor i kemi vid universitetet i York i Storbritannien. Nu har han jobbat med jämställdhet i 25 år och fortsätter för att alla och själva forskningen har att vinna på en mer blandad forskarvärld, menar han. Vägen dit handlar bland annat om att ta kontroll över det omedvetna.
If you imagine your brain the size of a football, what is the size of your brain that you've got some conscious control? And it's about the size of a table tennis ball.
Det här är Vera-podden från Chalmers tekniska högskola som möter Paul Walton, rådgivare för Chalmers jämställdhetssatsning Genie och tidigare tillförordnad ledare för Genie. Paul Walton forskar inom oorganisk biokemi och kallar jämställdhetsarbetet för en sorts hobby. En hobby inom vilken han har gjort omkring 150 gästföreläsningar, hälften utanför hemlandet, och som har gett honom kunskap om hur det ser ut med jämställdheten bland undervisande och forskande personal på universitet runt om i världen.
Every area of the world has made some progress in universities in the percentage of women in science or in universities. But you do see differences. Let me take Sweden for an example. Sweden is a pretty progressive country, very good for gender equality practice in society. And actually 50 years ago already had a high fraction of women in its universities, around 35% across all subjects. And that has improved now to probably about 44-45%, not 50%, and actually is showing signs of just kind of not making 50%. So that's an interesting debate. Go to a different country in the Western world, Japan, for instance. There, the percentage of women in universities is much less, about 20% female faculty. And again, there's been progress, but it's very slow. Why is there a difference? The difference is probably to do with society and the way that women are viewed, not only as, say, teachers or professors, but also their duties in society and the difference that might be they may have, say, in the home or caring for the family or whatever it may be. Then you can take it further and go to countries, ex-communist countries or communist countries, so China or Russia or something like that, and there you see very high percentages of women, 50% or so, female faculty in universities, but there you find that women don't get to the top positions in those universities. So just taking that small selection of countries, Sweden, Japan, China, you see differences. There is one message that comes through, though, in all of those, is that women are disadvantaged somehow, some way, when it comes to the workplace in universities.
So is there any place, any university or country that solved this?
No. even if they say they have, it's probably not a sustainable solution. You get close. So, for instance, the United States has a good percentage of female faculty, but they see pretty high rates of loss of women as you progress to higher grades. Other countries, and we'll go back to communist countries or ex-communist countries, have high fractions of women again, but you see the loss as they go to higher grades. Some subjects, let's say biology or psychology within universities, have very high fractions of women in the early stages, but also see some drop-off towards the higher grades. But at the higher grades, the percentage of women is quite high, but there's still a loss. Where's the closest I've seen to what you might call perfection? Well, Sweden comes quite close in areas like biology. There are some places I know of in the UK, and I would go back to my own department maybe, where we've worked on this for 25 years, where the percentages of women in chemistry in our case are higher than the national average, but most importantly, that there's no loss of women as they progress through the grades. But we're not there yet. And isn't it interesting? You know, I was thinking the other day how many countries I visited, how many lectures I've given, how many women I've spoken to across the world. And in every case, women have faced disadvantages compared to men. So you can see why my answer to your question is no.
What do these disadvantages look like? What do they consist of?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. It's a good one. I always categorize this into two parts. First is what you might call direct disadvantage. What do I mean by that? I mean harassment. I mean direct disadvantages in terms of the workplace, which are not corrected by the workplace. That can include sexual harassment. It can include bullying. It can include a whole set of things which are obvious. The second one is indirect. This is the harder one to deal with. But some people describe this in terms of microaggressions, but is perhaps better described as the small but slight disadvantages that women receive in the eyes of their colleagues in terms of their competence and their abilities. And so there are always, women are always met by these small downgrades in the eyes of others about how competent they are at their jobs. And so the combination of those two are probably the root factors why we start to see, in universities at the very least, this difference in how women can progress through the system. Now, those are two broad categories, and if you look at different universities or different departments, the importance of one either of those will change. Moreover, if you look at different subjects, particularly in science, say biology compared to chemistry compared to physics, the difference again will vary between the two categories. But in both cases, you could probably identify the root reasons for the reasons that women are disadvantaged down to this combination of direct and indirect effects. There's one third effect as well, which is the outside world. Of course, we all work in wonderful universities and we can understand the policies and the cultures there and try and do our best to deal with direct and indirect effects. But there's no doubt about it, is in the outside world, women continue to carry the burden of social care, of society care, of community compared to men. And so women have this extra disadvantage which they have to bring to the workplace. I've seen some interesting data on that. And, you know, how much disadvantage does a woman face? And can you quantify that in terms of how much extra work she has to do to achieve the same as a man? And those numbers are quite frightening. They typically about 30% is the extra effort a woman has to put in terms of society care and things at work where she can appear to be as good as a man. 30%, think about that.
What examples have you heard? What stories have you heard that you can share?
Lots. Most of the stories I've heard are from women who have faced direct disadvantage, direct harassment, and are looking for a place to describe this. And I would say every university I visited, a story like that has come up. And what might that be? It may be bullying in a research lab late at night, and how her male colleagues have a locker room culture which has made her feel excluded. In addition to that, there are lots of reports of how women feel marginalized and are not heard. I think the most common story I hear from women is that I am not listened to. My voice is not heard. And something I constantly refer to in my lectures is the example of a meeting where men and women are chatting away and a woman will have an idea and will raise that idea, and that idea will be ignored by the meeting. But then 5 or 10 or 15 minutes later, a man will have the same idea and, of course, receive all the credit. That comes up time and time again as something that women report is that they face, not just in universities, but kind of life in general. Of course, I've heard success stories as well about how women have cut through all of this and have championed, say, equality practice and have got to the top. And I think of one or two examples, particularly in the UK, of course, my home country, where women have really started at the bottom, but have, through determination and sheer hard work, have got to the top. And the stories they've told about how they've done this, it really is kind of often by just hard work, staying up late to complete this, getting up early to sort out the kids. That's often the message that comes through. In all those cases, though, where women have got to the top, and I mean to the top, they have also received comments along the lines of, well, she's got to the top only because she's a woman. She's got to the top because she's lucky. And so even the women who do achieve, deservedly, right, they're fantastic, still receive comments from their colleagues and their friends, which doubt their competence nonetheless.
What are the mechanisms behind this?
Most psychologists would tell you that our expectations of how men and women behave are laid down at a very early stage, and that by the time we're 10 or 11 already, we're behaving according to expectation. And once we break those expectations, say a woman behaves as a man or a man behaves as a woman, then in the eyes of others, that's counter-expectation, and they receive a small down credit in the eyes of people who are watching them. Because we expect women to behave in much tighter ways than men, yes, so women have to behave in a particular way in public that men don't have to, their freedom to behave is much smaller, and therefore the chances that they will not behave to expectation are higher, and therefore the chance that they will receive some kind of question mark in the eyes of their colleagues and friends is also higher. And you know, you might say, well, okay, that's not important. But psychologists have measured the effect of this. It's called the accumulation of disadvantage. And eventually, these small, little effects add up to something substantial. And that's probably the root of it.
Mm. And that is probably the answer to my next question actually, because I was thinking, I know so many nice and kind men, and things are pretty civilized most of the time at workplace, I hope, I guess. But so how does this happen in the end? I mean, is it... Do you understand my question?
I do. And, you know, most men, I think, when presented with the fact that they may be biased, or women for that matter, will go, no way. But it's hard to know ourselves, isn't it? I once heard this described by a psychologist who said the following. He said, look, you know, what percentage of your brain do you think you have control over? Yeah. And if you imagine your brain the size of a football, a soccer ball, What is the size of your brain that you've got some conscious control? And he looked at us all in the audience and we scratched our head. And I think I said something like, I don't know, 90%. And he said, no. He says, it's about the size of a table tennis ball. So what is that, 5% or something? And he said, the rest of your brain is on autopilot. Mm. And the decisions it makes on your behalf, you have very little control over. And if in there is built the expectations of how men and women behave, he said, then it's no surprise that we don't realize that we are responding to men and women in different ways. And I've seen some other work on this about how you can actually manipulate the bit of your brain you don't have control over. So the interesting effect of alcohol is interesting. If people drink, then they lose control of their conscious bit. The small bit. Yes, in my case, a very small bit. And then the true kind of uninhibited pattern of thinking may reveal itself. So yes, people will declare they're kind and nice. People may even think they're kind and nice. But the likelihood is they are falling into some pattern of thinking which contains all sorts of expectations and bias. Doesn't mean to say they are evil or bad or wrong even. It's just that they have equipped themselves with a brain over the years which cannot see things straight. And, you know, people say, oh, come on, Paul, I can believe this, but, you know, we're fully in control of our minds, professors in particular. And it takes an act of what I would call observation, where one would sit down and watch the dynamics of a meeting to reveal to people who think they are objective that actually they are subjective in their judgment. And that shows you how, I quite can't find the word, how blindsided we are, or blind we are to our own kind of biases that haunt the back of our minds, is that we say we're not biased, but actually we are biased, and it takes someone else to see that we're biased to reveal that bias.
Mm. You had an example from your own faculty. Will you please tell about that?
Yeah, so all the things that I've just said, I've seen for real, and have seen when we have been shortlisting for candidates, how one male candidate was assessed, and my colleagues chatted away about it and said, oh, what a wonderful CV. We really must shortlist person for interview, and we put this person on the shortlisting pile. Two or three candidates later, female applicant, basically the same age, roughly the same number of applications, and the conversation, very similar, has, you know, done great work, lots of great publications, just about to shortlist this poor candidate, and someone said, ah, ha, ha, wait a minute, she must have had some help in getting that level of achievement. And it was a perfect example of bias. Now, I know my colleagues, you don't, but if I was to tell you these colleagues are good, kind, gentle, well-mannered, completely committed to equality people, then I think it reveals what I've just said earlier, that despite our real kind of heartfelt commitment to these things, having practiced it for many years, we're still vulnerable to these expectations, which then do dramatically affect the way we make decisions about people. And to correct for that requires help, basically. In our case, we have observers that try and correct for this. Now, that's one extreme example, and I tell it because it's extreme, but there are others as well that come up in a more subtle way. And one example is that, again, during these meetings where perhaps we're looking for candidates for a faculty position, you find that men receive all sorts of extra help from outsiders. So they will email, say, people in the department, or they will call people in the department and say, you know, Professor Mann is very good. Women never receive that, never. And so where does that come from? Well, that comes from expectations outside the department or the group. And so one has to be very careful about those things too. And they're very subtle, aren't they? They're hard to see, and they're hard to correct for.
You've been working with these issues for quite a long time, and you are a successful white male professor. Why did you start thinking about these issues and working with them?
So the start came from the heart, right? It wasn't fair, and that was clear. And you didn't need to look at many data to show that. And certainly my own subject, I can recall 30 years ago seeing photographs of the people who were celebrated in my field for research success. And they were all men, all white, middle-aged men, right?
Thanks.
And I remember thinking, this is not right, this is not fair. So it became a moral crusade to begin with. But maybe the question you should have asked is, why are you still doing it after 25 years? And the answer is, in that time, I've heard too many stories. I've seen too many tears, seen too many broken hearts, too many dreams smashed to ever stop. And, you know, it's a privilege to go and speak about this. It is my hobby, but nonetheless, it's a privilege. And typically what happens is I'll go and I'll speak, and then there'll be discussions afterwards, and the stories will start to emerge. And I've lost count now of the stories I've heard of women being disadvantaged into careers into which they poured their heart and soul, and that they've lost out because of the biases and expectations I spoke about earlier. And of course, this is devastating. And it's those stories now which keep me going. I can't. It's impossible actually for me now to separate myself from that. I would be abdicating my moral duty if I stopped doing it. So that's the reason why, one, I started, it was, I felt it, and two, why I'm continuing, because I've seen it.
When you hear all these stories, which one is your worst example? One of the worst.
There are many. I can recall one, and I need to be careful here with confidentiality, mm-hmm. but sometimes when you speak, you find that there are two or three people in the audience who are completely fixated with what you're saying, and they stare at you when you're chatting. and you know that there's something there which is troubling. And this happened, it's about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. And there was a woman in the audience, and she was very carefully watching me. And at the end, there were questions, as there normally is. And then after the questions, people leave. And then there's another set of questions. There's people who didn't want to ask questions publicly come down to the front and ask questions privately. That's fine. And then there's a third set of questions, which is after that group of people have gone, there's one or two people, usually one, left, who not only didn't want to ask a question publicly, but didn't want to ask a question privately with others around. And this woman was there. Actually, I can remember what she was wearing, a lovely white jacket. It's so fixed in my memory. And she came over and I was packing up my stuff and she said, can I speak about something? I said, of course. And she said, look, you know, I need your advice. I'm currently a senior postdoc in a research group. And there's a position open in my research group, which is available. I'm completely qualified for it. I've been told I'm completely qualified for it. And my professor has told me that I will only get this position if I sleep with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There was little I could do other than to listen and to try and understand the emotional and psychological devastation that this particular woman was going through, who was seeing her career evaporate there and then, in that moment, because of, in this case, just direct, out-and-out, unchecked harassment. And you asked me what my worst story is. Mm-hmm. That's one of them, one of them. That's the one that sticks in my mind most of all, because I can remember it vividly. And if I close my eyes, then I can see it all happening in front of me now. And by the way, you can see why now I can't give up, because having heard repeated stories like that, and you know, some close to home here too, that you can't stop.
Hmm. What kind of resistance do you meet?
How long have you got? Resistance is everywhere. It comes from both men and women. It comes from organizations and it comes from individuals. How does that materialize? First, from individuals. There's always a group of individuals who, in universities, about 10% or so, who think that gender equality is dangerous, that it will start to break down the fabric of society. I've had this question many times. And as a result, we'll fight against it very strongly indeed. We'll be quite vocal. And we'll put together all sorts of arguments which appear to be that they have a case. Those resistances do appear. They're quite vocal. Typically, these people do not come to the talks I give because they're not interested. Occasionally they do, and it can lead to some arguments. The other resistances, though, are more subtle. And that is people who think it's a good idea, but are not prepared to change their behavior, and even will resist changing their behavior when they know they have to change their behavior when it comes to dealing with expectations. And how might you describe those resistances? Some people say, well, I'm not biased, so I don't have to do anything. Some people say there's no problem, so I don't have to deal with the problem. Some people say, well, even if there is a problem, why should I have to deal with it? How does it affect me? And those resistances stop people dealing with it. The most recent resistance, however, is the following, which is people are saying it's all gone too far. There's a word in the UK, which is it's woke. I don't know if this is a word that, yes. And it's too much. And actually, you see this in all sorts of spheres of life, don't you, that whether it's not equality, but say immigration or something like that, is people say it's too much, too far, we have to stop. This populism movement now is an active resistance when it comes to gender equity. And navigating that's going to be interesting and difficult over the next few years. And I don't necessarily have an answer of how we get through that other than to try and be patient and understand the problem as it presents itself. So yeah, there are resistances. There are also personal resistances. People doubt, people query, people suspect, anybody, particularly outsiders, men maybe, who are involved in gender equity. And those resistances are more personal than what you might call system or social difference resistances.
What can be done at the faculty level and even a personal level, in an individual level?
Yeah, the first thing is to raise awareness and have wonderful discussions like this, where we open up the thinking, make people consider their actions. Some money to support that, usually. And Jeannie's a good example of how money's made a difference in supporting appointments and providing what you might call gender-specific support to particular programs. But that then has to be coupled with allowing a community to change. How long does it take a community of people to shift their thinking away from a very biased situation to a less biased situation? The typical timescale, about 10 years. And what's the recipe to achieve that? Leadership, clarity of thinking, probably some change in the way that we reward and recognize within our universities, away from single investigator model to more team-based models. It doesn't mean to say we abandon single investigators, single project models, not at all. We don't want to lose the next Dorothy Hodgkin or the next Isaac Newton or the next whatever person, do we? But at the same time, we have to recognize the power of team-based interdisciplinary working, and that universities need to shift their promotion and recognition systems to do that. It takes time. It takes time. There's a journey with this, which lasts for decades, but nonetheless, it's a long time, but nonetheless, it's a journey. And the journey looks as follows. You start by thinking about it. You start by raising it. You start by awareness becoming part of what people do. That can be done pretty easily over a small period of years. Typically, that leads to some increase in the percentage of women at the junior grades in organizations, assistant professors, postdocs, the like. The next challenge then is to make sure that that investment or that part of the journey is not squandered, is not lost by the women that have come in feeling as if it's a good or a bad place to work. If it's a bad place to work, they'll leave and you lose the investment. If it's a good place to work, people stay. So the next part of the journey is to make the place a good place to work for both men and women, which is then this combination of culture, changing the academic model, getting people to understand their behavior, changing expectations. That's the hard bit. The minimum time scale for that is 10 years. Where's Chalmers in all of that? Where's Chalmers? It's probably done the first 5 years, and it needs probably another 10 years to get to a point where the index will be that there's no difference in the progression of men and women to the highest possible grades, possibly a little bit longer. So there's reason to be optimistic about this at Chalmers, because the journey is well set and you're on the journey. It's just now a matter of continuing on the journey with effective culture change. By the way, what's culture change? It is people like me and you leaving this place, thinking about it, talking to our colleagues, making sure that we correct, mention little biases that we see day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out. Why? Because it's through that slow but nonetheless long-term change of behavior that eventually the community will shift to a different expectation.
Du har hört Paul Walton, jämställdhetsrådgivare och professor i kemi vid universitetet i York i Storbritannien. Detta i ett avsnitt av Vera-podden med mig, Malin Avenius. I Vera-podden kan du höra om bland annat smartare plåster och proteser, bättre plaståtervinning och snabbare hästhoppning. Du hittar oss där andra poddar finns och på chalmers.se.